I'm Dr. Ruth Westheimer. And if you listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, you know that in most cases, size does not matter.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss how Project 2025 is rapidly degrading democracy by centralizing power in the hands of a few and undermining our time-honored system of checks and balances.
Our guest is Lauren Stiller Ricklin, the Executive Director of Lawyers Defending American Democracy. Her organization is dedicated to pushing back against threats to the Constitution and the rule of law.
We'll then check in with our own co-host, Stephen Rohde, who offers an analysis to confront the executive orders Donald Trump has issued, seeking to dismantle the Department of Education and control the curriculum for students at all levels.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
The early days of the Trump administration have ushered in a series of assertive executive orders that are rapidly reshaping the federal landscape. While new administrations typically bring change, most Americans expect such shifts to respect the rule of law. However, Project 2025 diverges from legal norms, challenging birthright citizenship, dismantling crucial federal agencies like USAID without congressional approval, and attempting to criminalize support for lawful diversity and anti-bias initiatives. Today's guest is Lauren Stiller Ricklin, Executive Director of Lawyers Defending American Democracy. She argues that the media has inadequately covered the full scope of Project 2025's goals. While the boldness of presidential actions has shocked many, these plans were outlined in the project's mandate for leadership. Trump's executive orders threaten protections for workers and marginalized communities while undermining checks and balances that ensure government accountability. Through these executive orders, the administration seems intent on reshaping the federal government to align with conservative ideals at the expense of civil rights and environmental protections. The goal seems to centralize presidential power and erase decades of legal safeguards against discrimination and environmental harm. We're delighted to welcome Lauren Stiller Ricklin to the show. An author of four books and editor of the 2023 anthology, Her Honor, Stories of Challenge and Triumph from Women Judges, she is also an active member of the American Bar Association. She serves as vice chair of the Advisory Commission to the Task Force on American Democracy, vice chair of the Advisory Council to the DEI Center, and co-chair of the Women's Caucus. Lauren, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Let's start by talking about Project 2025. What is it? What is its mission? And what is its impact on American governance?
Sure. We do have the next couple of days to go through this, right? Basically, Project 2025, it is a policy blueprint that claims to have been written for a conservative presidency. But in fact, it is a deeply extremist 900-page manifesto. It was published in April of 23. It states clearly it's a plan to dismantle the administrative state. They use those words. And it brought together more than 100 self-described, again, conservative groups to develop this plan to radically restructure the federal government. I keep saying I use the word conservative in quotes because, you know, conservative is one thing. This isn't conservative. It's truly extremist. And through it, there is the through line of the administrative state as something that they use as a pejorative to denigrate workers who perform the functions of the federal government. And when we consider what those functions include, national defense, law enforcement, the protection of public health and the environment, the postal service, public works, public transportation, you know, air transportation, as planes seem to be dropping out of skies of late. So this is what the federal workforce protects and does, and they claim it's the administrative state that has to be destroyed. And what Project 2025 does was create the blueprint. It emphasizes speed, and it sets up the plan for the president to immediately implement all of these policies. And one of the ways they did that was through vetting thousands of resumes to identify and interview people who could be immediately hired to do this work. And in the first month, we are seeing the results of that effort.
Lauren, in your recent article, Behind Trump's Executive Orders, Understanding Project 2025's Master Plan, you mentioned the media's shocked response to Trump's executive orders. Why do you think the press seemed caught off guard, by and large?
Well, you know, the problem is they shouldn't have been. Project 2025 described its plans in meticulous detail well in advance. But the problem is the media never fully covered the details of the plan to upend government from the outset. They covered some of the, you know, some of the language that may be more troubling, but they never got into the weeds. And the plan offers the weeds and the details. So here's a quote of their intent to dismantle the federal government. They say in Project 2025, our goal is to assemble an army of aligned, vetted, trained, and prepared conservatives to go to work on day one to deconstruct the administrative state. In other words, to destroy the government structure as we know it. The media's second significant failing is that it views all these actions through a partisan lens. So there was an article, in my article rather, I gave this quote that was an example of how the media treats this. This was a quote from the Washington, headline from the Washington Post. It said, many of Trump's orders are likely to be challenged in court by Democrats and liberal advocacy groups. Well, that sentence is as treacherous to the rule of law as many of the executive orders are. When the media characterizes those who are challenging these edicts as party-affiliated or liberal advocacy groups, what they're doing is they're diminishing the underlying threats to the rule of law, and they're relegating these legitimate challenges to mere partisanship. I also think it's a problem that the legacy media in particular, they insist on treating Trump like a normal candidate or office holder when he's really neither of these. Data shows that over his first term, he lied 30,573 times. Now, if somebody lies to you over and over and over again, at some point, especially when you're the media, you have to stop reporting the words without question or fact-checking, or at least putting them in some kind of context as to why they may not be believable. But the media still doesn't do that nearly enough. And the last thing I'd say in answer to the question is, as soon as it was clear that the public reaction to Project 2025 was negative, what Trump as a candidate did was back away from it and said, I know absolutely nothing about it. But getting back to the 30,573 lies, of its Project 2025's 307 authors and contributors, more than half had been in the first administration or part of his campaign or part of his transition team. Where was the focus on this at the time? So I get so frustrated by the media because I feel that it keeps missing this boat over and over and over again. And now they're surprised and shocked by the speed of what's happening and by what people are saying. And here we are in the most dangerous of places.
Lauren, speaking of the most dangerous of places, the day we are recording this segment, Trump took to his social media platform, Truth Social, proclaiming long live the king after he inserted himself in New York City politics on the issue of congestion pricing. You've said that the map of Project 2025 is unabashedly to dismantle federal government. But what is the ultimate goal here?
Well, you know, the question is an important one, and it also the image that you use is critical, because the notion that he himself would describe or use an image of wearing a crown, think about that. A conservative leader, a truly conservative leader, the whole thing is states' rights, right? You let the states do what they have. The federal government is supposed to be more limited. And here is a president saying, and I don't like what the state is doing in New York City. I'm going to now forbid that. So this is not a conservative form of government in any meaning of that word. So when you ask what's the ultimate goal, the authors are clear that the ultimate goal is to really dismantle government. And if you read, if you just take a read, or your listeners take a read of the 21 pages that is the foreword to Project 2025, what you see is its disdain for government as we know it, a real almost hatred towards federal workers that gets expressed. They see the federal government as the barrier to their vision of a Christian nationalist society where women have less rights, minorities are stripped of theirs, and the law cannot serve as a protective barrier. And so what stands in the way of that vision? The federal employees who serve to enforce these protections and who swore an oath to protect the Constitution. So they have to go. So just one more thing about this antipathy towards the federal workforce. Russell Vogt, who is the man now running the Federal Office of Management and Budget, was an architect of Project 2025. And when he was describing his work not that long ago, what he said was, we want the bureaucrats to be traumatically affected. We want their funding to be shut down. We want to put them in trauma. Now, first of all, what kind of human being says this? And now he is in charge of that workforce. And I think it's important to just note that in his first term working in the administration, he tried to recharacterize federal employees to make career workers easier to fire and to be replaced by political appointees. And he was unsuccessful procedurally in getting that done the way he wanted at that time. What Project 2025 does is show how advanced the thinking has become and the expectation of success far earlier in the administration.
Lauren, given your work in workplace rights and equity, what do you believe is the significance of removing terms like sexual orientation and gender identity from federal regulations?
Well, I think it stems from this dripping disdain for a diverse and inclusive society generally. So consider these words from the foreword. The foreword of Project 2025 states, the next conservative president must make the institutions of American civil society hard targets for woke culture warriors. This starts with deleting the terms sexual orientation and gender identity, diversity, equity, and inclusion, gender, gender equality, gender equity, gender awareness, gender sensitive, abortion, reproductive health, reproductive rights, and any other term used to describe, to deprive Americans of their First Amendment rights out of every federal rule, agency, regulation, contract, grant, regulation, and piece of legislation that exists. So this is really appalling in its breadth, in its scope, and in its cruelty. What Project 2025 is trying to do is eliminate these words from every federal statute, every rule, every regulation. And the what was conceived in Project 2025, we know is now being aggressively implemented. And we know it will bring this country back to a time when Jim Crow laws were legal, when sexual harassment in the workplace was a normalized part of the workday, when gay and lesbian workers were unable to live authentic lives because of the discrimination that they were facing. Laws and policies that offer reproductive health care coverage, pregnancy benefits, workplace accommodations for persons with disabilities, other protections against discrimination, they're all gone under these goals. And so let's be clear, by deleting these words, you erase the right to be protected from discrimination. It wipes out the comprehensive body of law that has developed for more than half a century that protects categories of individuals, that affirms legal rights. I mean, it's just an affront to human decency, but yet here we are.
Lauren, you have said that Project 2025 shows contempt for science and is therefore a major threat. How do these executive orders undermine scientific progress and public policy?
So if I may again, I keep going back to their words because I don't think the public really gets to hear directly enough what this document says and just how much it hates so much about what exists in our country. So Project 2025 stated the next administration will face a significant challenge in unwinding policies and procedures that are used to advance radical gender, racial, and equity initiatives under the banner of science. Similarly, the Biden administration's climate fanaticism will need a whole of government unwinding. So they're clumping everything they don't like together and calling that science that has to be gotten rid of. Essentially, it is their unabashed hostility to the independence of science. But yet not all science, just that science that supports an outcome which they consider to be woke. And sadly, the climate apparently is now considered woke. So Project 2025 proposed what we're now seeing, the elimination of dozens of science-based policies that address climate change, the environment, abortion, healthcare access, technology, education, science which supports their definition of woke initiatives or policies, that's now dismissed as mere junk. So they've turned scientific integrity on its head. They want to fire the experienced scientists who conduct research and who report the results and the conclusions methodically, as scientists do. And they want to hire political appointees who will adhere to the administration's preconceived policies regardless of the facts and the science. And unfortunately, Project 2025, you know, again, it calls climate science climate fanaticism, dismantling the nation's climate science infrastructure by eliminating multiple agencies and offices throughout the federal government. And that's what they're now doing.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Steve Rohde, and I'm joined by Heidi Boghossian. And we're today having the privilege of speaking with Lauren Ricklin. Lauren, listening to your last few answers reminds me of George Orwell's 1984. You eliminate words, and therefore you eliminate ideas from the entire public square. But has the media failed to prepare for this moment? How should the press at all levels be reporting on these executive orders?
Everybody I talk to is in such despair over media coverage and the bifurcation of information that people get, the algorithms that prevent people from seeing facts and reality. And, you know, I'm more a product of legacy media. What I get frustrated by is that they're not identifying and calling out those edicts and those actions that are clearly illegal and contrary to the Constitution and the rule of law. They're not sufficiently demanding facts and data to support statements, statements that are made in the orders, statements that are made in defense of the work that's being done. You know, these announcements of money that's being saved, every fact check that I've seen subsequently down the road shows where it's wrong. Somehow, you know, in the world of AI, we need to figure out how to fact check in real time when people are paying attention. And they need to demand transparency in this process. We have kids running amok in the government with our most private of data. And how can this be? Why is the media not demanding in much greater detail and reporting who are these people? What are their credentials? Why are they there? What are they doing? What happens in those offices every single day when these proteges of Musk are, you know, fiddling around with our Social Security and IRS data? Why do we need to delete every reference to diversity and inclusion in the federal government? Who is served by that? What are the dangers when we eliminate history and facts from government websites? Journalists are trained to ask a lot of questions. Here, the questions just cannot stop.
As executive director of Lawyers Defending American Democracy, how dangerous do you think it is to frame legal challenges to these executive orders as merely partisan opposition?
Well, I think that's the most dangerous thing of all. It undermines journalistic integrity by doing it. It fails to educate the public about what is really happening. It demeans the opposition because it makes it sound like, oh, it's politics as usual, when nothing about this time that we are in is politics as usual.
Lauren, Project 2025's vision clearly suggests a massive transfer of power away from Washington, or at least the powers that Trump doesn't want to exercise himself. What does this mean for the checks and balances that are at the foundation of American government?
It doesn't bode well. You know, essentially, Project 2025 did seek, and now it's happening, to the upending of these checks and balances that have been built into the governmental workforce for decades and longer. It's directly threatening the rule of law by removing legions of federal workers. Those federal workers swore an oath. They took that oath to support and defend and to bear true faith and allegiance to the Constitution of the United States. They did not take an oath to bear true faith and allegiance to a political figure. Yet so many of these people are now going to be replaced, and their oath will go with them, by what Project 2025 states quite clearly is a whole new cadre of political appointees who know that their job is to carry out the administration's instructions.
Lauren, can you briefly elaborate on the role of faith communities and local governments in the plan? You mentioned Christian nationalism earlier. Is this a shift toward decentralization or merely an ideological move?
Oh, I think it's just a total upheaval. You know, when, again, just a quick quote from them, you know, they say when the founders spoke of pursuit of happiness, what they meant was pursuit of blessedness, a pursuit of the good life found primarily in family, marriage, children, Thanksgiving dinners, and the like. Our Constitution grants each of us the liberty to do not what we want, but what we ought. So what they're laying bare is what they mean by freedom. They don't want us to choose how we wish to live, but we have to obey the duties imposed by their view of Christianity. They don't want us to have the freedom to pursue our view of happiness, but we should be pursuing instead blessedness. We shouldn't be free to find our own fulfillment, but we should do so within the confines of marriage and children. Our democracy, our freedom depends on respect for individual autonomy. And Project 2025 envisions the exact opposite, a country in which all people must live according to only one conception of the good life, this life of Christian blessedness. It violates the First Amendment's guarantee of religious freedom and its requirement that church and state be separate. So it's neither democracy nor freedom, but it's an anti-democratic state controlling the lives of its citizens.
Lauren, tell us more about Lawyers Defending American Democracy, the organization, when it was formed, its mission, and what is it doing currently to push back on the executive orders we're talking about?
Well, thank you so much for asking. We were formed officially formed in around 2019, and it came out of a plea to the legal profession by our co-founder, Scott Harshbarger, a former two-term attorney general, where he spoke about why isn't the legal profession doing more? Why aren't we stepping up and getting involved when democracy was under attack in 2017 and 18 and throughout that term? And since that time, we have become very active and involved in sort of two ways. One, trying to galvanize the legal profession to do more, and two, to educate the public as well. Because when we talk about the legal profession doing more, we are in essence saying, use your skills and your convening authority and everything else at your disposal to help the public understand this moment that we're in and the dangers that we're seeing to the rule of law. So we do a number of projects. They're all available. Everything we do is available on our website. We do an enormous amount of writing. We file amicus briefs. We do a lot of advocacy kinds of work. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, so we don't get involved in legislation. In terms of the work that we're doing right now, we're moving our Project 2025 talking points work that we had done over last year, helping the public understand what is behind the words and why it's so bad for democracy. And we're now moving into a project where we are matching up every executive order to their Project 2025 origins. And we are going to be coming out in a variety of ways with the results of that effort to demonstrate just how dangerous this is to our rule of law, making those connections, writing about it, trying to share it in every way possible so that the public and the media and people who are litigating these cases can understand the connection and the deep foundational roots. Because we have to understand the motives to understand where this is all heading. There are no surprises in front of us. We just have to be heads up and do the work required to see what's happening. So that's an example of special projects. We're working with students to try to bring democracy to college campuses nationwide in an effort called Students Defending American Democracy, also on our website. So we're trying to do as much as we can to sound the alarm about where our country is today.
Lauren, we have a few minutes remaining. Trump's actions have intimidated many, from nations, corporations, politicians, citizens, media members. Do you fear that legal professionals might be afraid of retaliation if they speak out or if they take legal action?
I think what we're seeing is all professions, Congress, everybody is going through this phase of fearing retaliation. I don't think, sadly, I don't think the legal profession has any lock on that reaction. I wish it weren't so. But this is the danger we face in an authoritarian regime. There is reason to fear retaliation because they threaten it. But we also know that you cannot cower to a bully. You cannot give in to, you know, you have to have courage in these moments or all really will be lost. So we have to step up. And it's not just the legal profession that has to step up. Imagine that the President of the United States just recently directed the Justice Department to stop enforcing federal bribery laws against corporations working in other countries. And we barely hear a peep from corporations that this is wrong. Yet they don't want that. They don't want to be in a situation where they can't hide behind the safety of this country's laws in when they are asked to bribe their way through their business dealings. But where is their voice? I was really proud that the American Bar Association issued a very powerful statement recently in support of the rule of law and our oath to protect the Constitution. And we are seeing slowly, not fast enough, more and more bar associations speaking out. We need law firms to be stepping up in droves to provide representation. We are seeing some, certainly, there were nonprofit groups doing this work, but we need a full-scale effort to respond.
Lauren, based on what you've just said, how can our listeners fight back against what's going on, even beyond all of the legal aspects? And how can listeners follow your work and the work of Lawyers Defending American Democracy?
Well, thank you so much for both those questions. First of all, in terms of following our work, as I said, everything is on our website, including how to contact us, and that is ldad.org, as in Lawyers Defending American Democracy, just ldad.org. We are on LinkedIn, and we're just finally joined Blue Sky. So that's how you can reach us. In terms of what people can do, every day I'm thinking about that movie title that should be our the guide for American citizens right now. Everything, everywhere, all at once. This is what we have to do and where we have to be. Figure out what you can do and do it. If it's calling your representative, if it's writing a letter, an op-ed, joining an organization, working with us, whatever it is, just do it. People can't, anybody who understands and complains about what is happening today has to figure out how they can take some step every day to do something to make a difference.
Lauren, you are quite an inspiration, and we so appreciate your joining us on Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to be on with you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Donald Trump launched his second term with an avalanche of executive orders, a shock and awe strategy to take over the federal government in defiance of the U.S. Constitution, Congress, and maybe even the Supreme Court. Especially dangerous is his plan to dismantle well-established programs and policies throughout American society that encourage diversity, equity, and inclusion, also known as DEI. Education is a key target. He intends to ban the teaching of critical race theory and either totally eliminate the Department of Education or, at a minimum, strip it of its key functions and funding. Why? Well, according to Christopher Rufo, a senior fellow at the conservative Manhattan Institute, writing in its publication City Journal, it's because the department pushes quote-unquote left-wing content on local schools and is a hotbed of left-wing ideologies, end quote. Aside from the rhetoric, though, what would be the true cost to our children and our society if the Department of Education is abolished? And is there anything that can be done to save it? We are so fortunate to have with us our go-to guest for constitutional and legal matters, Mr. Stephen Rohde, who also happens to be a co-host here on Law and Disorder. Mr. Rohde is a civil rights activist, author, and constitutional scholar. He practiced civil rights law for almost 50 years. He currently serves as chair of the Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, which was formed in the wake of 9/11 for the purpose of organizing faith-based communities to call for an end to war and violence. He is also a past president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and past chair of Death Penalty Focus and Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. And of course, despite his long list of affiliations, today he's not speaking on behalf of any of them. Steve Rohde, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Maria, what a pleasure it is to be with you today. Thank you.
All right, well, let's get started. On February 15th, Time Magazine published A Brief History of Efforts to End the Department of Education by Richard Stengel. I was surprised to learn that an earlier predecessor of the Department of Education was created by President Andrew Johnson in 1867, right after the Civil War. But the former Confederate states opposed the schooling of black children, so Congress ended up stripping it of most of its authority. President Jimmy Carter revived it 109 years later, and now we have a president who wants to make America great again by abolishing the Department of Education. Do you hear echoes from 1867 in today's attacks?
I certainly do, and the Department of Education has been a target of the right wing throughout American history. And it's very important for us to understand that this is nothing new. Trump is putting a new face on it. That example is very important because the first federal Department of Education was signed into law in 1867 after the Civil War. It was the brainchild of Northern abolitionists and universal school advocates who wanted to educate newly freed slaves in order to fully bring them into American society. Well, the former Confederate states, conservative white supremacists would have none of that. They blocked the legislation. They attacked the new Department of Education. And listen to how they attacked it. It's too big. It's too expensive. It's unnecessary. It's unconstitutional use of federal authority. But some were far more explicit than that. A New York congressman said, "Those thousands of lazy, idle Negroes, people who do not want to work, people who will not work, people who are supported out of the public treasury." And he went on with that kind of racist rhetoric. Sadly, that first fledgling effort at a Department of Education was trimmed back by Congress, and we went into a dark era in which newly freed slaves were not given universal education, and in which Jim Crow laws, segregation, and the rest flourished. But it's been a constant Republican platform. Ronald Reagan in 1980 campaigned, and let's all remember he campaigned, "Let's make America great again." Look it up. He called for dismantling the new Department of Education, which Jimmy Carter had established in 1976. So the effort to do this is ongoing, and that's exactly what Trump and his allies are trying to do right now.
Well, Steve Rohde, does a president have the legal authority to shut down the Department of Education by executive order or by any other means for that matter?
The crystal clear answer is no. I hope the courts, these executive orders by Trump, which we're going to talk about, are being challenged in court. It's very clear that we have a separation of powers in our Constitution. And I hope the originalists, the six conservative justices on the current Supreme Court, look back at the origins, as they're so wont to do in other areas, and they look at the power of Congress and the limited power of a president. Congress is given the power to make laws and to appropriate money. The job of the president under Article 1, Section 3, quote, and I have to use the male pronoun that spoils the Constitution throughout, quote, "he shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed." That's the job of the president, not to make the laws, not to amend the laws, but to enforce the laws as written by Congress. We are in a constitutional crisis because of his efforts to go beyond those powers. Separation of powers, checks and balances are very important principles in our government, and he's violating those across the board. And in more specific terms, if he doesn't abolish the entire Department of Education, he wants to trim it down. He wants to gut it by sending various parts of the Department of Education either to the individual states or to different departments within the federal government. And he wants to strangle the money that has already been allocated. Congress some time ago passed the Impoundment Act. A president cannot do indirectly what he cannot do directly. So he cannot strangle federal agencies and departments by not spending the money that Congress has allocated in the specific way that they've allocated it. So he's going to run up against the Impoundment Act. He's going to run up against the separation of powers. And we're hopeful that our institutions, the courts, and of ultimately the Supreme Court will hold strong on this and defend the Department of Education.
Can you please describe some of the executive orders that Trump has signed so far relating to education?
Yes, there's a plethora of them, but there are key ones. He couldn't wait beyond the first day in office, January 20, to issue a executive order called Ending Radical and Wasteful Government DEI Programs and Preferences. The next day, he issued Ending Illegal Discrimination and Restoring Merit-Based Opportunity. On January 29, he issued two executive orders, both of which are ominous. He issued an order directing federal agencies to determine how to expand school choice, and he issued an order to develop a strategy to end what he considered radical indoctrination in schools. All of those executive orders run afoul of what we've talked about. And there's one other element I want to introduce, a doctrine called unconstitutional conditions. This is another indirect method that autocrats have used to frustrate the Constitution. The federal government gives a lot of money, and wisely so, under the Department of Education to school districts, to states, and to companies who work in the educational field. Trump is trying to tie that money by imposing unconstitutional conditions on the money. And fortunately, there's a wide body of law that prohibits that as well. Once again, I hope the courts hold tight. And if they do, most of these executive orders will be blocked.
Well, speaking of the courts, can you update us on some of the key legal challenges that have been already filed against Trump and their constitutional implications?
I'm very proud of our civic society that has built up over the decades. Many organizations are prepared for the onslaught that Trump is producing. There are admirable nonprofits, terrific lawyers, capable of going toe-to-toe with the new Department of Justice. There are also extraordinary lawyers within the states, the attorneys general of various states, 22 of which are controlled by Democrats. So two lawsuits have been filed, which our listeners should watch very carefully. On February 2nd, the National Association of Diversity Officers in Higher Education, the American Association of University Professors, the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United, and the Mayor and City Council of Baltimore, Maryland, all sued the Trump administration in the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland, attacking the very executive orders that we're talking about today. They're attacking it not only on the constitutional principles I mentioned, but they also believe these executive orders violate the First and Fifth Amendments because they chill free speech. They chill academic freedom, which has robust protection in our constitutional law. And many of these statutes or executive orders are vague, using all kinds of rhetoric and inflammatory language, but vague laws run up against the Fifth Amendment right to due process. A second lawsuit was filed just days ago, as we are recording this interview, by the National Urban League, the National Fair Housing Alliance, and the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. That lawsuit, a 101-page complaint, catalogs the constitutional and legal flaws in these executive orders. I think these lawsuits are strong. I think they're well-founded. Elsewhere, since January 20, many courts have issued preliminary injunctions against other executive orders, and I'm very hopeful that in one or both of these cases, the same is done to restrain Trump and his enablers from dismantling the Department of Education.
Well, Steve, you mentioned academic freedom, that it's under threat. What has the Supreme Court said about protecting academic freedom?
Well, it's good news if the Supreme Court follows its own precedent. As early in this modern era as 1957, shortly after the McCarthy period, in a case called Sweezy versus New Hampshire, in a 6-2 opinion written by Chief Justice Earl Warren, the court held that academic freedom is protected by the Constitution. Justice Warren stressed that equally manifest as a principle of a democratic society is political freedom of the individual, protected by the First Amendment, and that education and academic freedom are pillars of that doctrine. Justice Felix Frankfurter agreed that a free society depends on free universities, and he went on to elaborate those principles. That is solid, well-established law. Those principles were reaffirmed in Keyesian versus Board of Regents in 1967. In a powerful opinion written by Justice William Brennan, briefly he said, "Our nation's deeply committed to safeguarding academic freedom, which is of transcendent value to all of us and not merely to the teachers concerned." And he went on to elaborate on that. It was in that case that he pointed out that vague and ambiguous laws leave too much discretion to government officials, and he encouraged courts to uphold First Amendment freedoms because they need breathing space to survive. And I think those precedents are being cited today. They are good law. We need a robust protection for freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and academic freedom on our college campuses and in our high schools. That's really what DEI and the teaching of critical race theory is all about.
If you're just tuning in, this is Law and Disorder. I'm Maria Hall, your host this segment, and I'm speaking with constitutional law scholar Stephen Rohde. So, Steve, who are the people being harmed by Trump's gutting of federal funds for DEI and education?
When I first thought about that question, I was inclined to speak to the students who help with special programs, students with disabilities, students in disadvantaged communities, poor urban and rural communities that benefit from these programs, as well as women and LGBT youth and others. But, you know, I thought more broadly about it, and the real answer to who benefits from these programs is everyone. All students, parents, teachers, as well as you and me and society at large, we benefit from creating a more diverse, equitable, and inclusive educational system. It benefits the entire society. We've had programs of affirmative action for many years, and it's misunderstood that the courts have not struck down affirmative action in all respects, even when it comes to affirmative action and DEI programs. Sadly, the conservative court a few years ago banned the consideration of race in the admission to university systems and in the hiring of university personnel. But there's a wide array of affirmative action programs, DEI programs, that survived the court rulings. that have enriched our classrooms and have enriched our educational system. And I'm hopeful that those will survive this period. Now, we can't ignore the fact that we're facing a conservative Supreme Court with six members that is inclined to do Trump's bidding. After all, last year they gave him criminal immunity for his conduct as president. I am deeply concerned about our current Supreme Court. I'm hopeful that at least a handful of those conservative justices will see the value that these programs have given to the American people and will realize there are no constitutional obstacles to upholding those programs under settled law and the kinds of cases that I've spoken about already. I think this is a time where that court has to see past serving the Republican agenda, which, as I've indicated, is largely a recall of periods of segregation and of white supremacy. They may not call it in those terms. They may find a limited and modest way to uphold these programs. But like many other of the executive orders that have been issued since January 20, when the full impact of these programs hit the American people, when their uncle and aunt, their child, their neighbor down the street are put out of work by these executive orders, when school becomes strained in what it can teach, after all, that's what the target of critical race theory is all about. Now, that was a theory developed in law schools. It's a high-level theory that says when you examine American institutions, you cannot ignore the original stain of slavery in your analysis, and that the badges of slavery and the legacy of slavery persist down to this very day. Teaching a form of critical race theory in age-appropriate ways at different levels of school is nothing more than teaching a comprehensive study of American history. Teaching that history is exactly what Donald Trump and his enablers don't want to do. They want to close the American mind. They want students to serve the patriarchy in government. They don't want critical thinking. They don't want students who question authority. That's what's really at the stake of all of that's going on here. And that's why it's so important that we organize and fight back.
Steve Rohde, you've been a peace and justice advocate and activist for a long time. So give us your summation here. What are some of the best case and worst case scenarios?
The best case scenario is that judges, and we're talking for this segment about litigation, although we'll expand on that in a moment, judges are already seeing through the threats, the language, the intimidation that's embedded in many of these executive orders. And a series of preliminary injunctions have been issued. I'm hopeful that the judiciary will be in an admirable moment in its history in this case. And if that plays out, then these cases are teed up for the U.S. Supreme Court. I think all of the precedents are there, and I'm imagining there's a case pending right now before the Supreme Court because he fired a special counsel who was legally protected by Congress for a five-year term and could only be removed for cause. I'm hopeful the Supreme Court will uphold that individual's reinstatement and we'll get an early signal of how the court will handle this. The founders understood that we needed three separate independent branches to serve as a check and balance on each other. It's already dangerous that today the Republican Party is in control of the White House, it's in control of the Senate by a slim margin, and it's in control of the Congress. And with six Republican justices, essentially it's in control of the Supreme Court. I don't think James Madison contemplated political parties of this kind and the kind of concentration of power into a single ideological political party. The best case scenario is the law prevails, the court holds Trump accountable and strikes down these various executive orders and some of the rulings and regulations that are already being implemented. Worst case scenario is we are in for a dark period. That what if the Supreme Court does rule in favor of the Constitution and Donald Trump defies the Supreme Court, even if the court does the right thing? It's actually happened in American history a few times when presidents have flaunted the Supreme Court. We've later come to regret that. And that may be the second part of your question. That's when the people are going to have to demonstrate. We're going to have to need widespread organizing throughout the United States if that kind of threat occurs. The worst case scenario is the court itself rules against these lawsuits, and that'll be a dark day. Some of it may be corrected by congressional acts. And I just want to identify other aspects that your listeners can consider as we confront the Trump administration. The courts, I think you can hear it in my voice. You can see it in my career. The courts have meant a lot to me, and they've meant a lot to the progress of American law in the best sense of the word. But they have fallen by the wayside. They've ratified the internment of the Japanese and upheld McCarthyite periods. And there are deep blemishes on the Supreme Court. So we have to know that we cannot rely entirely on the courts to save us. We have to depend on our own activism. I'm proud of people across the country who last week on President's Day rose up in small communities and large communities to protest against what Trump is doing. I'm proud of members of Congress speaking up and growing a spine and deliberately confronting the Trump administration.
Well, Stephen Rohde, as we end our segment today, please tell listeners how they can learn more about you and your work.
Well, they can tune in to Law and Disorder every week. I'm proud to co-host this show and to guest from time to time. Independent media is crucial. You and I, Maria, with Jim Lafferty, do the Lawyers Guild show on the Pacifica Network at KPFK. There are many outlets of independent journalism, and I try to write for as many of them as I can. LA Progressive, Truth Dig. I've begun to write for Project Censored and other publications as well. All my material is online at those publications and elsewhere. And if you've read something I've written that touches you, that moves you, that is of an educational value, pass it on to family and friends. It's the circulation of this kind of accurate, comprehensive information that I think is so important.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen Rohde, constitutional law scholar. Thank you also for doing our homework for us, because I know it takes a lot of reading to go through those court cases and the voluminous articles out there. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Maria, it's truly my pleasure. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
It's just insane. We have the most insane system of health insurance on the planet. We're the only industrialized country, the only developed country that in which the citizens of the country can go bankrupt or lose their homes or die because they don't have coverage or they get their policies canceled.
That's Wendell Potter, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Wendell Potter on health insurance, an insane system. The murder of UnitedHealthcare CEO on a midtown Manhattan street unleashed the New York Times reported, a torrent of morbid glee from patients and others who say they have had negative experiences with health insurance companies at some of the hardest times of their lives. Some of the comments were thoughts and deductibles to the family. Another one said, unfortunately, my condolences are out of network. The dark commentary highlighted deep anger over the state of health insurance. Millions simply can't afford it and go without. And many who are on some plan have such inadequate coverage and high deductibles that they can't afford to pay for anything. The answer, Ralph Nader says, is single payer. Everybody in, nobody out. That would bring down prices, but the handful of corporations who monopolize the health insurance industry don't want that. Why? That would cut into their profits. So the insanity continues. Our guest today is Wendell Potter. He was a former Cigna public relations executive, and today he's an outspoken critic of the health insurance industry. This classic from the AR archives is even more relevant today than it was when it was originally recorded over a decade ago. Wendell Potter spoke at Powell's Bookstore in Portland, Oregon.
I think I'll begin by just answering a question that I'm often asked when I am speaking to groups, and that is, why did you do what you did? Why don't more people do what you did? And what led you to do what you decided to do? There was no one thing that led me to do this. It was a culmination of a number of things. I had a wonderful career in the health insurance industry. I've actually had two careers. I was a journalist, and I had a very good career as a journalist. I was a reporter initially in Memphis and Nashville, and then finally in Washington, and I covered Congress and the White House and the Supreme Court for a few years. But I decided to go into PR, first in a political campaign. I was a press secretary for a guy who ran for governor of Tennessee. And from there, my PR career just meandered, and it took me from one place to another, and I eventually wound up working for a big for-profit health insurance company, Humana, based in Louisville, Kentucky. At that time, Humana was largely known as a hospital company, and I was hired to help promote and defend and be a spokesperson for the hospitals that the company owned. After doing that for 4 years, I was recruited to Hartford, Connecticut to support Cigna's healthcare operations. Cigna at that time was a very large multi-line insurance company. It had a property and casualty division, a financial services division, and a reinsurance division. And I was hired to help raise the awareness of Cigna as a health insurance company. Insurers were beginning to catch on to the fact that a lot of money could be made in health insurance. When I worked at Humana decided to get rid of its hospitals because the executives and shareholders thought that they could make more money if they focused on managed care and health insurance. So they spun the hospitals off to a different company and focused on managed care. And I became the chief spokesperson for Humana and was doing that when I was recruited to Cigna. And Cigna likewise saw that there was a lot of money to be made in health insurance and got rid of its property and casualty division and the other divisions that shareholders felt were not as profitable as health insurance could be. So Aetna did the same thing. Aetna's mix of businesses was very similar to Cigna's during that time, and Aetna did exactly the same thing. It got rid of those other divisions so it could focus on making money on health insurance. When I joined those companies, I thought that managed care was truly a good way to provide finance health care in this country, and I still think that as a concept, it's not bad. We have some still very good, I think, solid and reputable players in the managed care space. Some people might disagree, but I think the Kaiser model is one that has worked pretty well for a lot of people, and here in the Pacific Northwest and some other parts of the country, like the northeastern states, where primarily there have been nonprofit organizations that have provided health insurance. What really happened was back about the time that I was working for Humana, Both Humana and Cigna, by the way, are for-profit companies, as you probably know. They're two of seven very large for-profit companies that now dominate the health insurance industry, and I work for two of them. Now, one out of every three Americans is enrolled, if you're insured, in some kind of a benefit plan sponsored by or offered by one of these seven big companies. The for-profit companies began to dominate in the years following the collapse or the failure of the Clinton health care plan. And we saw the conversion of a lot of nonprofit Blue Cross plans to for-profit status. And we saw a consolidation in the industry. And now we have a lot of the Blue Cross plans around the country are owned by this big, gigantic company called WellPoint. So we've seen enormous change in the industry. My point is that initially the concept of managed care was, again, something that worked pretty well for a lot of folks. But when these companies saw that they could make a lot of money on managed care, that's when things started getting, our healthcare system took a turn for the significantly for the worse. One of the things that led me to finally decide that I was not in the right business, I was growing increasingly uncomfortable being a spokesman for an industry that was pushing more and more of us into so-called consumer-driven plans. You may have heard the term, but it's a kind of a euphemism for plans that have very high deductibles. And what they are doing is pushing more and more of us into these kinds of plans that require us to pay a lot more money out of our own pockets for care, even if we have insurance. We're paying premiums every month, often as much as we have in the past, but we're getting far less value for it. Often they shrink the benefits or they eliminate benefits, and they make us pay a lot more out of our own pockets. WellPoint has a plan in Maine that is requiring people to pay $30,000 out of their pockets before the insurance will pay a dime. That is the trend, and I was growing increasingly uncomfortable being a spokesman for these kinds of plans. They're extremely profitable for health insurance companies, and that is one reason why these companies have recorded record profits. When I was working for Cigna for 10 years, I handled financial communications. I was the person who explained to reporters who called every time the company announced earnings how the company made its money and whether or not it met Wall Street's expectations. That is the most important thing to these companies, is whether or not you're going to meet Wall Street's expectations for profit. And if you don't, your stock price will go down. And when that happens, if you're an executive, so will your stock options. And you do not want that to happen. So the first priority is always to meet Wall Street's expectations. You're financially invested in this. And the CEOs, for example, at Cigna, the CEO, 90% of his salary is at what they call at risk. And it's determined on whether or not the company performs to Wall Street's satisfaction. And if he doesn't, he doesn't get as much. But if he does, he makes an enormous amount of money, millions and millions of dollars every year. I was worried about these plans, and I did not believe, as I was having to say, that this was the new silver bullet to get more people covered and to provide adequate coverage. What I really was learning was that it is a primary reason why we now have not only 51 million people who are uninsured, we have at least half that many, if not more, 25 million, as estimated by the Commonwealth Fund, who are underinsured. They're paying premiums, but they have plans that are so inadequate that if they do get sick, they're going to be on the hook to pay so much out of their own pockets that people are still losing their jobs or filing bankruptcy, losing their homes because they simply cannot make the out-of-pocket expenses that's required of them. If you consider that the median household income in this country is still just roughly around $50,000, and the average cost of a family health insurance premium that is purchased through the workplace is about $13,500.